All right, that's done. Okay. So tonight's topic is the Fabulous Salamander. Okay. So there used to be a pagan custom for people to sacrifice their children in the fire. And the Talmud says in Source 1, also with Hizkiah, king of Yehuda, his father sought to do so, that his mother smeared him with salamandra. Okay, so Hizkiah's father also wanted to sacrifice him in a fire, that his mother smeared him with a substance called salamandra, and thereby rendered him impervious to the flames. So what is this salamandra? So, source number two, Rashi defines what a salamander is. Salamander is a small creature that emerges from an oven that has had a fire burning in it for 7 years. If a person smears himself with its blood, fire has no power over him. Alright, so before we discuss what type of creature this may or may not be, let's just look at two more sources about salamander. One second, I'll just plug my phone. Okay, so in source 3 it says there are creatures that thrive in fire and not in air, such as the salamandra. How so? When glassmakers heat the furnace for 7 consecutive days and nights, out of the thick of the flames emerges a creature that resembles a mouse, which people call salamandra. If a person smears his hand with its blood, or any other of his limbs, fire has no power over that part of him, because the beginning of the salamander's development is from fire. Okay, so we're saying now that the creature is generated from a fire, it looks like a mouse, and that its blood renders you fireproof, because since the creature is generated from fire, it has some innate fireproof qualities that are transferred by its blood. And then in source 4, we have one further statement of Amanda. As the rabbi taught, this is a quote from the telling to its kind, to, and also the Nephilim and the Salamandra. You know, these verses are speaking about different types of creatures, small creatures that transmit tumma, spiritual impurity. And it says that this phrase of according to its kind includes these other animals, the Arvad, the Nephilim, and the Salamandra. And when Rabbi Akiva would reach this verse, he would say, how great are your works, Hashem. Like, Marabu Masecha Hashem. You have creatures that grow in the fire, and you have creatures that grow in the air. Those which grow in the fire would die instantly if exposed to air. So there you have it. You have these statements from the Talmud and the Midrash about this salamander that is born in a fire, and whose blood renders a person fireproof if they smear themselves with the blood. Question is, what is this creature? Is there any such thing? So, of course, the fact that it's called salamandra, leads us to think that there must be, maybe there's some connection with a creature that's today called salamander. Right? I mean, the creature that's called a salamander today is so called because that's been its name for a very long time. That was its name in Latin or Greek or whatever it was. And then the Gemara speaks about salamander, right? That's not a Hebrew word, that's a Greek or a Latin word. And it's reasonable to presume that, you know, it's probably talking about the same creature. Not definitely, but probably. Now, of the various salamanders that exist today, there is one that is actually called the fire salamander. If you look in the other side of the page at the bottom, here's an illustration of it. This is a fire salamander. It's black. It has very bright, shiny yellow or orange markings on it. It's poisonous. Not by its bite. It has glands behind its eyes that release poison onto its skin. They live in Europe and Israel. You find them like under stones and streams. Now, why is it called the fire salamander? So, two reasons. Number one, its coloration is very brightly marked, like the flames of a fire. And number two, because of this legend that it comes from the fire. Now, most zoology books, what they say is as follows. They say that this legend is, of course, myth. Animals are not born in fire. But the reason why this myth came about is that salamanders like to hibernate inside logs. So people would get their logs and they'd throw the logs on the fire. and the hibernating salamander would quickly come running out of the log. So, you know, if you were watching it, you wouldn't realize that the salamander was hiding in the log. You'd think that the salamander was actually generated from the fire. So that's how this legend arose about salamanders being generated from fire. Okay. Now, the difficulty with that explanation is that, you know, the Talmud, in the first source, it speaks about Chizkiah being smeared with salamander and thereby surviving a fire. Right? In other words, here's a historical account of somebody who was saved by being smeared with salamander. So, you know, what are we going to say about that? It's not necessarily heretical to say that this isn't a literally true story, but certainly rather not say that it's all possible. And there seems to be a historical account here of salamandra, the substance salamandra, being used to render somebody fireproof. Let's take a look at source number 5. Source 5 is from the Sefer Ha'aruch, which is a kind of a dictionary of Talmudic terms, which was written about 800 or 900 years ago. And it says as follows. Salamander, the Chelad and the Achbar, are translated by the Yerushalmi as the Kalkusha and the Salamander. It is explained that when a fire burns for 7 years in one place, something that resembles a mouse is created from it, and it is called salamander. Okay. Now we have a parenthetical comment by Binyamin, which is Rabbi Binyamin of Musafia. He was a 16th century linguist who wrote a commentary on this Sefer Aruch. So Binyamin Musafia says as follows. The ancient ones stated that which they stated. But the truth is that because of its moisture and cool temperature, it is not destroyed by fire until after considerable time. Okay, so he says as follows. So what he's saying is that really the fire this salamander is the salamander that we know, and really it doesn't have any magical fire retardant qualities. It's just that it's an amphibian. It's moist. It's a cool amphibian, and therefore it's not affected as far by fire as quickly as other creatures are. So this is a very interesting comment. We see that he's not afraid to, you know, quietly point out that it's not actually factually true. Right? What the Gemara says about the salamander being generated from fire, it's not necessarily factually true. It's just that because it's a moist and cool animal, it's able to survive longer in fire than other things. But it's not a satisfactory explanation. Basically, again, this doesn't account for the historical statement of Chizkiah surviving a fire by being smeared with salamandra. Binyamin Musafia says doesn't account for that. Secondly, the idea that because salamanders are moist and cool, they can survive flames for longer, that also seems problematic. You know, salamanders are amphibians, along with frogs and toads. Now, frogs and toads are definitely, because of their moisture, they're more susceptible to heat than other creatures. See, creatures like reptiles have hard skin, and reptiles do very well in hot, dry environments. That's why you'll see a lot of reptiles in the desert and so on, in arid climate zones. But amphibians are different. Amphibians have soft skin that's porous, and they do some respiration through their skin, and they need to have moisture in the air in order for them to survive. If you put an amphibian in a hot, dry environment, it will die. Right? If you have a pet frog or toad or salamander or newt, you always have to make sure there's moisture. Amphibians live exclusively in moist areas. The only exception that I can think of is the spadefoot toad. The spadefoot toad lives in the hot deserts of Arizona. And what the spadefoot toad does is that even then, you know, even in the hot desert, still every couple of years, there is rainfall. When that happens, the spadefoot toad quickly, you know, it breeds and it lays eggs, and the eggs hatch in one day. The tadpoles metamorphosize very quickly within a few days, and then before the rains, the puddles totally dry up. What they do is they dig themselves deep into the mud, and they secrete this mucus which hardens around them to form like a watertight shell, just leaving two tiny holes for the nostrils. And basically, they go into a state of suspended animation for years and years and years until next rainfall. Spadefoot toad. Let me type it in there. So they dig themselves into the sand, you know, they go into the state of suspended animation, and they remain that way for, you know, 10, 20 years until the next rainfall come, and then they have, you know, one or two or three weeks of frenzied activity when they go through the whole process again. So, you know, that's the only amphibian I know of that survives in a hot, dry environment, and that only survives by basically going into suspended animation until the environment becomes temporarily moist. But amphibians in general do not do well in hot, dry environments. In fact, I actually used to have some fire salamanders. I caught them in Nahal Meron, near Safat in Israel. I kept them in an aquarium in my room, and one day I accidentally left my heater too close to the aquarium, and the salamanders all died. They shriveled up into little corpses. Very sad. So we see that salamanders are, in fact, don't do well with dry heat. You know, there's this theory of the Yomasakia that because they're moist animals, they do better in heat. It's just the opposite. The fact that they're moist indicates that they're amphibians, and amphibians do very badly in heat. Look at a few more sources. Here we have in source 6. Source 6 is a ref which says, "Fires of hell have no power over a Torah scholar." We'll look at that source 6 later, but let's just see what this commentary says on it. Says, like a garment made out of the wool of the salamander, which is impossible to clean other than with fire. So here we have a new aspect being introduced, the idea that a garment can be made out of salamander wool. Now that doesn't fit in with the salamanders that we know, because salamanders that we know don't have any wool, right? Amphibians all have smooth skin, with the single exception of the hairy frog of Africa, which has hairy legs. They're not real hairs, they're hair-like skin filaments, but salamanders certainly don't have any wool. So what's going on here? And if you look at this picture next to it, so this is actually an illustration of a salamander from a medieval work, and it shows it as possessing wool. Now the reason for this is that in the Middle Ages, there salamander wool was sold. It was an item that was imported from the Far East, and it was a very much sought after item. Salamander wool was used to make fireproof clothing. Now what was it? Any ideas? Come on, class. What was salamander wool? Okay. Well, what it was asbestos. Right, asbestos is a mineral that develops in the form of fibers. And you can actually take the fibers and weave them together to make a cloth, a very rough cloth, that you can make a cloth out of it. So asbestos, which was discovered in the Far East, was sold off in Europe as being genuine salamander wool. That's what people thought it was, right? Because it was a fibrous substance, people thought it came from an animal. And because people, you know, there was this idea that there's a salamander that's born in fire and is fireproof, so people were quite ready to believe that this wool came from a salamander. That was the most reasonable thing to believe about this wool. But we now know that asbestos, what it is, it's not the wool of a salamander, it's actually a mineral. And people don't use it anymore because it's carcinogenic. It was found to cause cancer, and that's why all the buildings that were made fireproof with asbestos are now having the asbestos removed from them very carefully. So this idea of salamander wool, garments made out of salamander wool, we see that has nothing to do with the real-life salamander. But there's another interesting account of a garment being fireproof. It's in Sefer Hasidim, which is a work from about 1,000 years ago, and it's in Source 7. There was an incident where a Gentile brought a garment and said to the other Gentiles that it was the shroud of the Nazarite. And he said it was Jesus' shroud. He told them, "If you don't believe me, look what I can do." Into a fire, and it didn't burn. The priest then said to the Jews, "See, now you know that there's sanctity to this shroud." Now, parenthetically, I just want to point out that what I would say is, okay, big deal. So it's the shroud of Jesus and it didn't burn. It doesn't prove he's the Son of God, right? I mean, we have no problem in Judaism with people of other nations doing miracles. You know, Bilam was a prophet. So, you know, the fact that this was supposedly the shroud of Jesus and it didn't burn, you know, okay, thanks, so a miracle for Jesus, very nice. Doesn't prove he's the Son of God. Anyway, Sefer Hasidim relates to that. Somebody else there gave a different response. A wise man said, "Give it to me and I'll show you what is in it." He took strong vinegar and soap, and he washed the shroud in front of them. Then he said, "Now throw it into the fire and test it." They threw it into the fire and it burnt. They said to him, how do you know how to wash it? He replied, because it was smeared with salamandria, and I needed to clean it off from the garment, after which it would burn. So here we see an account of salamandria being some kind of substance that is applied to fabric. And it's not a garment made out of salamander. It's a regular garment that's flammable. But when it's smeared with salamandria, it becomes fireproof. So, again, what could this be? Let's have a look at another discussion about this salamander blood. Okay, so the Talmud says, makes a kal vachomer, an a fortiori line of reasoning. It says as follows: if the fires of hell have no, no, sorry, flip over the page. Look at source A. So if one can take issue with that which they said at the end of tractate Chagiga, that the fires of Gehenim have no power over a Torah scholar, deduced a fortiori from the salamander. So the Talmud says as follows: if with a salamander, which is only a product of fire, if a person smears himself with its blood, fire has no control over him, and with a Torah scholar, whose entire body is fire, how much more so? Right, that's what the Talmud says. The Talmud says that a salamander comes from fire, and its blood renders you fireproof. So a Torah scholar, whose entire body, you know, he's burning with the fire of Torah, figuratively speaking, so how much more so fire, in terms of the fires of hell, will have no control over him, right? It's making this you know, allegorical idea, showing that a Torah scholar won't suffer in hell, because if a salamander comes from fire, and fire has no power over it, then somebody who's made of fire, fire certainly won't have any power over him. That's what the Talmud says. Then the source, Maharit, raises a question with this. He says, this is difficult based on all the sources that we have cited, which indicate that the punishment for a Torah scholar is harsher than for anyone else. There's an idea in Judaism that somebody who's a Torah scholar doesn't become immune from suffering in hell for his sins. On the contrary, he's held all the more accountable for his sins. So what's this idea that he's immune from the fires of hell? So he explains as follows. He says, what I've been told about the blood of a salamander is that it is impossible to collect the blood except when it's inside the fire, and there they kill it. But if it emerges, it dies instantly and the blood is absorbed. So he's saying that the way that the kal vachomer, that the exegesis of the Talmud works is as follows: that the salamander blood renders you fireproof if you take it while the salamander is in the fire. So to the Torah scholar, as long as he's immersed in Torah, he's going to be protected from sin. And it's as long as he's within the fire of Torah that he has protection. It's like the salamander blood only has its potency if it's collected while the salamander is in the fire. Okay, so this is another factor about the salamander substance that we're being told here, that the salamander blood is only effective if it's collected while the salamander is in the fire. Now let's just look at one more source here, from the Ramban in source 9. Ramban says, a rabbi stated that also with Chizkiah, king of Yehuda, his father sought to do so, to burn him in fire, but his mother smeared him with the oil of salamander. Okay, that's what we saw earlier, but with one very significant difference here. Earlier, all the other sources we looked at, they spoke about the blood of the salamander, whereas here, Ramban is speaking about the oil of the salamander. So is it the oil of the salamander, or is it the blood? What is the oil of a salamander? So the truth is that the word dam in Hebrew, which we translate as blood, doesn't exactly translate as blood. Dam really means any fluid from the creature. Right? So for example, in discussing the tcheles, right? Tcheles is the blue color, the blue dye that was used for tzitzis and for various items in the temple. Right? So the tcheles is said to be the blood of the chilazon. Now the chilazon is a type of snail called Murex trunculus. It doesn't have regular blood. What the tcheles is, what this blue dye is it's a secretion. The snail has a certain sac inside its body which secretes this dye. Right, so dam doesn't really literally mean blood of a creature. It means any fluid secretion of the creature. So whether we call it, you can call it blood, you can call it oil. It's not necessarily blood or oil. It's just a fluid secretion of the salamander that has a fireproof potency. Okay, so what are we going to say about all this? So certainly the idea that a creature is generated in fire, I feel confidently saying that that's scientifically impossible, right? It's not just that we don't happen to know of any creatures that are born in fire, and it's not even just that, you know, we've studied salamanders, we've bred them in captivity, and we've seen that they don't come from fire. It's more than that. It's everything we know about the natural world, which is quite a lot, tells us that animals are not generated in fire. But what about this idea of the salamander secreting a substance that makes you fireproof? So when I first taught this class 10 years ago, so at the time I said, you know, it doesn't sound especially likely, but I can't rule it out as being impossible. You know, maybe, you know, animals often have all kinds of bizarre aptitudes. We know that the drug companies are constantly sending out research teams into the rainforest, you know, to find new species of creatures before they're hunted to extinction. You never know which creature might have the next, you know, contain an astonishing medical cure. So who knows? I said 10 years ago, maybe there is some kind of substance in salamanders that has fireproof qualities. Doesn't sound likely, but possibly. So a couple of years ago, a new research tool became available, Google, and the internet. And I did some hunting around, and I found something very interesting. I found a report by a naturalist called Mark Stromberg, who's from the University in California. And he was not studying salamanders, he was doing fires. Right? We know that, you know, in the US, where do you live? You just email me where you live. In the U.S. for many, many years, they had this campaign to stop forest fires. Oh, Toronto, okay. In the U.S., they had campaigns for many years to stop forest fires. Right, so they're very, very careful to stop all fires, and even, like, you know, fires that occurred naturally from lightning, whatever, they were very quick to put them out. And it was a disaster. Because the fact is that fires are very beneficial. You know, in the wild, when the fires burn, they burn up all the leaf litter and so on. You know, the detritus in the bottom of the forest floor, but they don't burn long enough or hot enough to really damage the trees. So they just burn off on the surface. This cover, clean it all up, and then it grows back. The problem is that if you stop forest fires for years and years, and the undergrowth up, and then eventually if the fires break out, it's going to burn so much longer and deeper and hotter than it's going to be not going to be devastating to the trees. It will actually kill the trees. So when people realize that, you know, all this thing of fighting fires for so many years was a big mistake, so now what they do is they do controlled fires. And they're very carefully now doing controlled fires to undo the damage that was done by stopping fires for so long. So this naturalist, Mark Stromberg, was doing a controlled fire in California. He's burning the leaf litter. And he writes that he noticed that two salamanders suddenly came crawling out of the leaf litter. And now salamanders have all kinds of glands over their body. They have their, I mentioned earlier, they have these poison glands behind their eyes. They also have various other types of glands that produce different types of mucus to keep themselves moist. And this naturalist reported that they started secreting mucus and it started frothing up. The effect of the heat was to make it froth up into a foam. And they were totally coated in this frothing foam, and they were able to walk through the flames and emerge safely. It's amazing, right? It had this astonishing report, and it's not as though this guy had some salamander agenda. He was working on something completely different, and he happened to notice this. And I wrote to the world's greatest salamander expert to ask him about this. He said he'd never heard about it, but he does happen to know Mark Stromberg, and he knows that that guy is a very careful naturalist who reports his observations very carefully. So, you know, number one, you know, please be vindicated that we see that, yeah, it appears to be true. Salamanders do produce a secretion that renders them fireproof. I don't know of any further research that's been done in this area, but we can see that all these reports about salamander blood having fireproof qualities appear to be true. It appears to be that salamanders do secrete a substance that has fireproof qualities. Absolutely incredible. Now, so the lesson to take from that is that, you know, all these zoology books which are saying that these legends of salamanders and fireproof salamanders are complete myths. Now, it's not true. Right? There is truth to this. You shouldn't be so quick to write off ancient beliefs as myths, because sometimes there can be truth to it. But, you know, we're still not going to go so far and say that the salamander was generated from fire. Okay, now the first quote from the Talmud didn't mention anything about salamander being generated from fire. It just said that Chizkiah's mother smeared him with salamander juice. Right? So we see that could well be true. Right, it could well be true that salamander juice does have fireproof qualities. But then later, Rabbi Akiva, and in source 4, Rabbi Akiva did understand that the salamander is a creature that grows from fire. So what are we going to say about that? So let's look at source 10, which is a quote from a Shimshon of Falhirsch. It says, in my opinion, the first principle that every student of Chazal's statements must keep before his eyes is the following. Chazal were the sages of God's law, the receivers, transmitters, and teachers of his Toros, his mitzvos, and his interpersonal laws. They did not especially master the natural sciences, geometry, astronomy, or medicine, except insofar as they needed them for knowing, observing, and fulfilling the Torah. We do not find that this knowledge was transmitted to them from Sinai. We find that Chazal themselves considered the wisdom of the Gentile scholars equal to their own in the natural sciences. To determine who was right in areas where the Gentile sages disagreed with their own knowledge, they did not rely on their tradition, but on reason. Moreover, they even respected the opinion of the Gentile scholars, admitting when the opinion of the latter seemed more correct than their own. That's referring to a debate in the Talmud between the Jewish scholars and the non-Jewish scholars as to where the sun goes at night. And in the Gemara, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says that it looks like the Gentile scholars are correct. And they were happy to concede that the Gentile scholars knew more science than they did. The Hirsch continues, imagine if a scholar such as Humboldt that lived in their times and had traveled to the ends of the world for his biological investigations. If upon his return he would report that in some distant land there was a humanoid creature growing from the ground, or that he had found mice that had been generated from the soil, and had in fact seen a mouse that was half earth and half flesh, and his report was accepted by the world as true, wouldn't we expect Chazal to discuss the Torah aspects that apply to these instances? What laws of defilement and decontamination apply to these creatures? Or would we expect them to go a long journey to find out whether what the world has accepted is really true? And if, as we see things today, these instances are considered fiction, can Chazal be blamed for ideas that were accepted by the naturalists of their times? And this is what really happened. These statements are to be found in the works of Pliny, who lived in Rome at the time the Second Temple was destroyed, and who collected in his books on nature all that was well known and accepted in his day. So here you have it. The Hirsch is addressing the case of a mouse growing out of dirt. That's a case discussed in the Talmud. And there's no such thing. Mice do not grow from dirt. However, in those days, people did believe in such things. Pliny the Elder, who was the Roman naturalist of that era, he wrote about these things in his natural history books. So the sages of the Talmud, they read the zoology books, and they believed it. And there's no reason not to believe them. Just like today, we believe in many creatures, duck-billed platypuses, and many other things that we haven't seen with our own eyes, but we trust National Geographic and the zoologists who are reporting them. So in those days, the sages trusted Pliny the Elder and the naturalists who reported these creatures. It wasn't the job of the sages to send out a research team to the ends of the earth to investigate if these creatures really existed. They trusted the experts. So the fact that the sages, spoke about creatures that don't really exist, there's any reason to look down on the sages in any way. It doesn't mean that they were naive or gullible. They relied on the experts in their time, and that's what the experts reported. And so in Rabbi Akiva says, Maradu Masecha Hashem, how greatly your works Hashem, and he talks about the salamander that grows in fire. Okay, Rabbi Akiva wanted to talk about the wonders of creation. So in the local zoology book, it says that there's this amazing creature, the salamander, that grows from fire. When he wanted to speak about how great are your works, Hashem, the wonders of creation, he spoke about his creature. He spoke about it growing from fire. We now know that salamanders don't grow from fire. But we have other aspects to talk about how wonderful they are. We can talk about their incredible skin secretions that have fireproof qualities. Right, so there's no reason to look down on the Akiva statement. We're just going to transfer it to a different aspect of salamanders. Now, coming back to this case discussed by Rav Hirsch, right, so Rav Hirsch speaks about this case of the mouse growing out of dirt. Now, again, there's no such thing. The Talmud discusses that in the context of working out laws of Tumah and Tara, spiritual impurity and purity. You know, the law that dead mice transmit spiritual impurity. So the Talmud discusses, well, what about this creature, this mouse that grows out of dirt? So if you get one of these, and it's when it's half grown, it's half dirt and half flesh, does it transmit spiritual impurity or not? So it discusses that if you touch the flesh part of it, you do become impure. If you touch the dirt part, you don't become impure. Okay, so now we know there's no such creature. But it doesn't mean that that law is irrelevant. You know, there's an interesting law, and it may have aspects that may have ramifications, other ramifications. For example, the other end is the ear mouse. An MIT, scientists were working, not MIT, sorry, somewhere else. There were scientists and doctors who were working on the problem of making prosthetic ears. Sometimes kids lose ears, you know, in fights or so on. You have to make a new ear. So what they figured out is as follows. They get a mold, you know, a biodegradable piece of plastic in the shape of an ear, which they inject with human flesh cells. Then they transplant this into the back of a specially genetically engineered mouse that's been genetically engineered not to reject the human cells. Then this human ear lives on the back of this mouse, and over time the plastic breaks down and it's gradually replaced by human cartilage cells. And then when all the plastic is broken down, they remove the ear from the mouse. They stitch up the mouse and send it to an old age home, whatever. And they transplant the ear onto the human. At least in theory. I don't think they've ever actually transplanted one of these ears, but they have produced a mouse with ears. You know, if you do a search for it on the internet, or you email me, yeah, I'll send you a picture of this mouse with a human ear on its back. So let's say Mashiach comes, and you're working in this research institute, and this mouse, ear mouse, dies, and you touch it. Are you Tomei or Tahar? Are you spiritually pure or not? Well, you might think that you're stuck, because, you know, the Gemara doesn't discuss ear mice. Well, no, it doesn't, but it does discuss mice that grow out of dirt, which is the same basic idea. You know, a mouse that's part mouse, part non-mouse. So that's where you find the law. So we see that, you know, even if the law, the discussion in the Gemara is based on inaccurate science, it doesn't mean that the law doesn't have, you know, important ramifications. There's an idea in law of discussing theoretical cases, even if they're not actually true, but because they can have ramifications for real-life cases. Okay, so even in cases where the Talmud is scientifically inaccurate, but it's not any reason to look down on it or to devalue it, because it still has relevance and importance. Okay, any questions? Wait, this isn't the last class, this is the second to last class. I thought that we've had four classes so far, right? We had elephants, birds, leopards, and salamanders. So we have one class left, so I think that it would be next week. Yeah, I figured that we do the fifth class next week, no? Davis? Okay. I don't need to know now. People, you just all let me know by email what it's going to be. Which book? Man and Beast? Ah. Tell me, what school are you down at in Toronto? I'm thinking of coming to Toronto for a week or so. Either at the beginning of January or the beginning of February. So I'm looking for places that will hire me as scholar in residence. What's your school in Toronto? Okay, I don't know that one. Okay, so we'll find out what's doing in the next class. Okay, Deborah, maybe you could ask them if they're interested in hiring me for scholar in residence for Shabbos for a weekday lecture, if they do that kind of thing. I'm either coming. It looks like it'll be either the first week in January or the first week in February. Okay, great. Thanks very much. Okay, let's call it a night. I'll see you either next week or whenever the next class is. So hopefully Jay will send out an email. Alright. Okay, kind of just a minute.